Welcome to Few and Far Between, conversations about rare disease research. I'm your host, Chris O'Brien. On today's podcast, I'll be talking to Dr. Terry Jo Bichelle. In the early days of videotape, and after filming a difficult birth in West Africa, Terry Jo switched from working as a documentary filmmaker to become a public health nurse midwife. When her son Lou was later diagnosed with Angelman syndrome at the age of one, she switched again, this time from midwifery to clinical research on Angelman syndrome, earning a PhD in neuroscience from Vanderbilt University in a quest to find treatments for Lou, who is now an adult. She directed the Angelman Biomarkers and Outcomes Measures Alliance from 2016 to 2018 and currently leads Combined Brain, assisting other rare genetic neurodevelopmental disorders in clinical trial readiness. Terry Jo is a rare disease patient advocate and is active in local and regional politics. She is a lecturer in neuroscience at Vanderbilt University, teaching an undergraduate course in neurodevelopment from diagnosis to treatment. I'm sure you're going to enjoy this episode. I know that I did. Hi, it's Chris O'Brien. Welcome to Few and Far Between. Our guest today, Dr. Terry Jo Bichelle, is the chairman of Combined Brain, a consortium that works on solutions for rare and ultra-rare neurogenetic disorders. Welcome, Terry Jo.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited.
Lots of exciting stuff for us to talk about. But first, I want to go back in time to a point earlier in your career. You worked as a documentary filmmaker, I guess. Will you tell us a little bit about that story and how that led you into life sciences and medicine?
Sure. So when I was in college, I was all excited about women's lib and feminism and women's rights. And I really thought at that point that the best way to change the world was with film and video. We didn't have podcasts yet. And so I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker in order to help women's causes. I worked on some really fantastic documentary efforts that were all in West Africa and East Africa too, actually, about women's health and maternal mortality and access to contraception. That was how I really thought, you know, I could help make an impact on women's rights. And so I was working as editor and assistant director and videotaper and a translator. I spoke French. And so we videotaped all over in so many different settings, in birth centers where people were giving birth, in hospitals, in really big cities, and way out in teeny tiny little villages. And we filmed traditional midwives, and we tried to help show what life was like for people, for women in these little teeny villages. And one day we were filming in this little bitty village in Côte d'Ivoire in the Ivory Coast in West Africa. And we were sitting in a ring of midwives. All the traditional midwives had come from all these neighboring villages. And we were sitting there and we heard this scream from the other side of the village. And this lady who was the midwife from that village just jumped up and ran off. And there was a lot of discussion in the circle. And we asked the chief if we could go and follow her and film. They talked back and forth. Somebody ran over to the little hut and asked, and they said yes. And so we went over there, the cameraman, the sound person, and myself. And we went into the little hut, and what had happened was that this really young girl had just given birth to a premature baby in the hut on the ground. And because the midwife was in the meeting with us, the midwife wasn't even there in the hut with the girl. And it turned out the midwife was new at her profession, didn't really know exactly what to do. And so the poor little baby was cold and not wrapped up and not cared for, you know, at that moment while we were videotaping. And so what we videotaped in that moment was the death of this little baby.
Oh my God.
And it was horrible. And also what I felt sitting there behind the camera was, somebody do something. It just felt like, oh my God, we should have been able to do something to help this baby and help this mom. And I just felt so powerless behind the camera. So at that moment, I decided to be a clinician. And even though up until then, I thought film and video was the most powerful way to change the world, after that moment, I thought, no, I need to know what to do in that moment. I need to be a midwife myself, or an MD, and I need to be able to handle this situation the next time I'm ever faced with it.
That is a wonderful response to a feeling of powerlessness, is to figure out how you can become powerful and effective in that moment. So, wow. So that was a major fork in the road for you, for your professional life, I guess.
Yeah, that's when I shifted from being a documentary filmmaker to being a nurse midwife. And here's the funny thing. I got to say, 5 years later or more than that, now I'm back to thinking that video and film and maybe podcasts can actually change the world a lot.
They're here.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lots of different ways to have an impact. All right. I'm going to jump forward in time a little bit. So your youngest child, Lou, was diagnosed with Angelman syndrome. When did that happen? And what was that like?
Thanks. So I was going along being a midwife and I loved it. I worked in San Diego, in Boston, in a hospital in Boston, in a birth center in San Diego, and I taught midwifery in Mexico. And I loved it. I loved working with the women and working on breastfeeding and empowering women to make decisions. I loved it. I could see myself doing that for the rest of my life and being perfectly happy. And by then, we had 5 kids. My son Lou is our youngest. So when Lou was born, there was something different about him. He was not like my other children. By then, I had seen a whole lot of babies, and he wasn't like the other babies. There was something different about him, but I couldn't really put my finger on it, and nobody could. So we kept thinking, oh, you know, maybe he's just a little behind, or maybe he'll catch up. He had trouble nursing. He cried a lot. He didn't roll over right when he was supposed to. Well, that's actually not true. He rolled over right when he was supposed to, and then he quit after a week. He laughed all the time. He was super cuddly, and he smiled early and he laughed early. So we thought he was really smart because he had such a great sense of humor. However, something was not right about him. I couldn't connect with him. I was really worried almost that he couldn't see me, that he somehow didn't know who I was compared to anybody else who walked through the room. And I kept telling that to people. I kept saying, something's the matter with the baby. Help me figure out what's the matter with the baby. I asked so many people. My husband is a congenital heart surgeon. So he's works in children's hospitals. All our friends were pediatric physicians of some kind. And so I'd be all the time saying to people at parties, at picnics, look at the baby. What's going on with the baby? There's something the matter with the baby. And everybody told me, you're nuts. Everything's okay with the baby.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You're overreacting. You're a classic parent of a new baby who's seeing things that aren't there.
Yep. Over and over again. And then finally, when he was over a year old at a cocktail party on a New Year's Eve, when I had the baby on my hip, a friend of ours who later became a pretty famous geneticist said to me, you know what? He's got this little birthmark right here. He has a funny cowlick at the back of his head. His hair is blonde and everyone else in your family has brown hair. His eyes are light green and everyone else has brown eyes. I think it's genetic. You need to go get a genetic test. This was 21 years ago. you couldn't get a whole genome sequencing. You couldn't even get a microarray. You had to test for one gene at a time. So my husband and I had a textbook that had pictures of children with genetic disorders, and we would flip through that. And every time we came to this one page, we would say, gosh, he looks like those people with Angelman syndrome, doesn't he? But it says here that they have severe intellectual disability. And he's really smart because look at him. He's got such a great sense of humor. How can you only laugh at things that are funny unless you're really smart? So finally, we got an appointment with the geneticist and I took the baby there and I had him on my knee and he took a whole history and he said, did you have any idea about what you think might be going on? And I said, well, whenever we come to the page on Angelman syndrome, we think he looks like those people, but he can't possibly have that. Anyway, that doctor, who it turns out was one of the main authors of that book, Ken Lyons-Jones, he only asked for one test, and that was the gene for Angelman syndrome. The reason is because, guess what? Sense of humor, laughing a lot, is one of the main symptoms of Angelman syndrome.
Wow. So then you ran a single gene test. It's a monogenic disease, right? So you're able to identify with that single gene. You get the results back that, in fact, he has Angelman syndrome. What do you do then?
That was a little bit like being in that hut in Africa, because what I felt right then is I don't know enough about how to help this baby. Mm-hmm. I got to find out what to do. And so my husband and I sat there with his medical textbooks because, you know, as a nurse midwife, I kind of skipped over a lot of the molecular aspects. And so we sat there with his textbooks on the couch every night and did a crash course and tried to understand what was going on with Angelman syndrome. And what we looked at was seemed to us something you could treat. And so we contacted all the experts in the field. And one of the main ones was Dr. Art Baudet, who actually had identified the disorder. He had found the gene for Angelman syndrome. And so we contacted him and he said, yes, I think this is a treatable disorder. I think this will be curable in your son's lifetime. He said that more than 20 years ago.
Wow, extraordinary.
It is. And so everybody else we talked to thought it was insane because you never, they called it mental retardation then. And no one thought you could treat mental retardation ever.
Right.
That if you were born with intellectual disability, you were always going to have intellectual disability. So when we were saying, no, look, there's a gene. It's sitting there on the father's side. It's just turned off. All we have to do is turn that on. The gene on the mother's side is missing, but the gene on the father's side is just sitting there. How hard can it be?
You must have been a big hit with all the geneticists that you talked to. How hard can it be?
That's right. But Art Baudet thought that too. And he was the world expert. Mm-hmm. So we worked then with some really amazing people, Dr. Lynn Bird, also in San Diego, and Carlos Bacino in Texas also. And we got together one of the first clinical trials for Angelman syndrome. It didn't work. But when we got it together, when we did the clinical trial, even though it failed, we learned a ton about Angelman, and we also learned how to not run a clinical trial in Angelman. And we learned that there was a lot we didn't know about the syndrome, that we didn't know about what lives were really like for people that had Angelman syndrome or for their families. And so what we really learned from that is that we had to collect all that data. We had to learn everything we could about Angelman syndrome so we could run clinical trials better.
So Terry Jo, at some point in here, you went back to school again. Yeah. Where did that happen in this chronology?
Yeah, I'm collecting degrees. So what happened is we ran clinical trials for a while. I kept working as a nurse midwife. And bit by bit, I wanted to spend more of my time working on the clinical trials and less time being a midwife. Finally, none of the trials were working. And I started to think that there has to be a faster, better way. All these academic researchers, you know, they were grant driven and they had to get funding from the NIH. So they were looking at all this basic science. They weren't looking translationally. And I really thought, okay, I need to go back to school and get a PhD in neuroscience. And what I want to do is a high throughput screen, which was, you know, kind of new then because stem cells were kind of new. And what I wanted to do, this was about, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago. So what I wanted to do was take human Angelman cells, turn them into neurons, and then measure what could increase the paternal gene's expression in those neurons. And so I went back to school to Vanderbilt to get a PhD, and I got that project going. And I made neurons. I had incredible luck, and everything worked out. And I was about to launch into the next phase of my PhD studies, which would have been to do that high throughput screen. And then somebody else did it. But which is great.
Win-win.
Because, yes, when you're the parent of a kid with a rare disease, you should never care who gets the answer. So it was Ben Philpott at UNC, University of North Carolina. And so I thought, okay, this is fantastic. They've already figured out a way to activate the paternal gene. It turns out that wasn't the very best way, but that's okay. So now in the middle of my PhD program, the point isn't anymore to figure out what we can do to activate it. Now the point is back to what we were looking at before, which is how do we measure it? How do we set up the clinical trial? How do we know if the drug's working? Somebody's got to do all that. So ever since I graduated with my PhD, that's what I've been doing. I've been working on biomarkers and outcome measures for Angelman syndrome, and then now for 26 other disorders that are all pretty much like Angelman. They all have a lot in common with Angelman syndrome. And so we can kind of use everything we learned from Angelman and help those different disorders, and then use what they're learning and go back and help Angelman again.
Yeah, that's so great. So before we get to Combined Brain, you founded another organization specifically focused on Angelman's. Is that right? That was the first nonprofit that you created?
Yeah, that was actually never a separate entity. I was hired by the two Angelman foundations, the Foundation for Angelman Syndrome Therapeutics and the Angelman Syndrome Foundation. The two foundations were kind of rivals. They're getting along really well now, but back then they were kind of rivals. And so they hired me. I was always trying to be friends with everybody. So they hired me as a person who was independent of both organizations to run this effort, which was a project called the ABOM, which was the Angelman Biomarkers and Outcome Measures Alliance. And we pulled in about 100 researchers, about 40 pharmaceutical firms, and all the foundations that were working in the Angelman field. And we wanted to have everyone work together pre-competitively to try to do this stuff that they were all going to need to run clinical trials. So that was the ABOM.
Terry Jo, how did you do that? Because so we had, not only do you have pharma companies, biotech companies that are inherently commercially rivals with each other, you have academics who might be pushing their own personal research agenda, and then you even had two competing Angelman's organizations. So how did you weld that into the fantastically named ABOM?
Well, it's not a smooth course. I mean, you know, there are a couple steps forward, a step back. But I think most of the time when people see that they can get further in where they want to go by collaborating, they'll collaborate. So I find that by appealing to someone's selfish motives, you can often get them to collaborate.
Altruism through selfishness, kind of.
Exactly. Uh-huh. So For example, I mean, if there's a researcher that really needs to publish, but they just don't have enough data, but they have this pool of data, and you have another researcher who has another pool of data, if you can get them to work together, they can both get a publication out, they can both get more grant money in the future. If you have two pharmaceutical firms that both need biomarkers from cerebrospinal fluid, but for one of them to do all that work and pay all that money is going to cost twice as much as if they work together, you can get them to work together. They see that they can get where they need to go faster for less money, and they could still win the race. They could still actually beat their competition by collaborating.
So that's great. So were you then, I guess you were in a position because you were seeing what everyone was doing, you could see these opportunities to share costs or share data, share resources that would still enable them to achieve their sort of broader objectives. Is that right?
Yeah, that's exactly how it would go. So a lot of the times I just was a diplomat or some kind of a mediator, but it was because I understood the science and also because I understood the parental politics, I could really kind of help everybody get to the table. And, you know, it didn't always work. And sometimes it really fell apart, which was frustrating. But all those groups are working together better now than they ever were before. So even though it didn't always work, it seems to be moving in that direction in general.
That's fantastic. And so, yeah, I guess I hadn't thought about that, but the combination of your status as a parent and as a scientist, that combination would have given you kind of double credibility, I guess.
It helped, for sure.
Fascinating. Okay, so you were directly involved with that until 2018, I guess, and then Combined Brain was born. Tell us a little bit about that. What is it? And then maybe you can tell us the foundational story there.
So Combined Brain was envisioned as kind of blowing up the A-bomb and turning it into something that was even bigger and better. And so what Combined Brain was set up so that it could really be, it's a patient advocacy organization. So it's run by patient advocacy foundations. So that makes it very special. It's a nonprofit entity. It can approach the FDA as a patient advocacy organization. And so that gives it more nimbleness in that kind of a situation. We don't have industry advisors on our governing board, but we can have industry advisors on our industry advisory board. So that means that industry can have input into what they need or what phase they are in their drug development. We can have clinicians and researchers on our advisory board so they can all talk to each other. So if one guy researching SYNGAP1 has figured something out that actually could help somebody with STXBP1, then they can talk to each other. So the whole idea was that we would help all these different disorders at the same time. And that would give us a lot of economies of scale. And we want to collect natural history data. We help them do that. We help them find a way to collect specimens, biospecimens. So we have a new biorepository, and that goes across all of our disorders. We found a special number, a secret number called the CRID, www.thecrid.org, which stands for Clinical Research ID, and patients own their own number. So they go get that number. And then if they put that in every study they're ever in, it can link all those studies together over time so that we can have pools of data linked. We work on, you know, trying to get ICD-10 codes for all these groups and then looking up mortality and morbidity data for them. We basically do everything we possibly can for getting each of these disorders fast tracked to clinical trial. So by doing it all at the same time, over 26 disorders, we can do it all faster. It takes less money and less time.
Fascinating. And tell us a little bit about the disorders. How many people suffer from a typical disorder that's one of the 26?
Oh, yeah. These are rare.
Yeah.
These are little bitty rare disorders. But I'm telling you, we only launched 2 years ago, and some of the disorders told me at that time that they had 8 or 12 or 15 identified patients. And even those that had only that many are up in the hundreds just in 2 years' time.
Wow.
So the field is exploding. And that's because of whole genome sequencing. That's because of all these genes being added to the microarrays. So now when somebody has seizures, they get the seizure panel and you can get a much faster diagnosis. And really, we're trying to push very early diagnoses. So we're trying to come up with a way, it's called Project Find Out, infant neurodevelopmental diagnosis by outpatient testing. And that is a way to either do universal newborn sequencing so that right when babies are born, they will get sequenced whether they have a symptom or not, or for neurodevelopmental disorders, just a couple things that you might red flag and you go ahead and do the sequence. So just if the kid has trouble feeding, remember how my kid had that?
Yep.
Hypotonia, missing a milestone, my kid had that. A seizure, any of those things, abnormal movement. So really not very, pretty vague except for the seizure. If you have any of those things, then you we're trying to push a protocol where you order whole genome sequencing.
And is whole genome sequencing difficult to get for parents and patients these days? How does it play out in practical terms?
Well, it's still kind of hard to get, but I think within a year or two, it's really moving fast.
It feels like it's going to become the norm, right?
Yeah. Right now, it's still hard to get it. If they do get sequencing, they get whole exome. There's a long delay before the order is made. It's hard to get it paid for. And then even if you can get it paid for, it's sometimes hard to get it properly interpreted. But all that is also changing. So I'm sure by the time I retire, it's going to be routine.
Terry Jo, you have, was it 25 or 26 organizations that are part of Combined Brain today?
26.
Yep.
Are you looking for more, or are you open to additional conditions joining?
We have a long waiting list.
Yeah.
And we would dearly love to let all those organizations join. We are limited by our staffing and our funding. We have a grant from the FDA. It's really cool. I forgot to mention it. A measure of communication abilities in Angelman. It's called the ORCA. It was originally funded by the FAST Foundation, and it's a way to measure communication abilities in kids that really have very low communication abilities. And so we're trying to expand that in a very systematic and well-validated way to 12 of our other disorders. So we have that grant. We have some other grant, but until we can enlarge our staff, we're maxed out. So we're hoping this coming year to be able to enlarge our staff and let in a bunch of disorders off our waiting list.
Yeah, fantastic. I know there are a few other initiatives that you're excited about. You know, do you want to talk about the 40% and or other, wherever you want to go? Let's talk about what is motivating you now. I think you're not trying to get another advanced degree, right? You're focused.
I think I'll never do another PhD again. Oh my God. Although
I think that's fair.
Although my husband, who's a heart surgeon, is talking about getting a master's in fine arts when he retires. No, not me. I think it's school. I'm good with school. No, yeah. Thanks for asking about the 40%. That would have been terrible if I forgot to mention it. There's this interesting new organization. It's called the 40%.org, but the 40 part is a number if you're looking it up, and percent is spelled out. So anyway, what they're trying to propose, because what they show is that treatments for rare diseases, it's really hard to get the research funded through the NIH. If you look at the criteria for funding an NIH grant, there are 5 things that have to be measured by a review committee. And when you answer and rank each of those 5 things, it kind of automatically pushes it into basic science and away from translational research. Mm-hmm. So you might get more and more and more basic science done on a certain disorder, but you're not going to get a treatment for it. So what he showed, this guy, Richard Wang, who's the dad of a kid with a rare disease, but he's also a molecular biologist, and he's been on a bunch of review committees for the NIH, and he figured out after his kid was diagnosed that the criteria made it impossible for him to even approve a grant that he thought was a great grant that could be translational. So he started looking into it, and he looked up that it turns out that really a whole lot these days of translational research is done through private patient advocacy groups, or at least the seeds of it are, the seed money or the start is. So groups like are in the groups in Combined Brain. And so his idea was, what if you could have the NIH actually fund some of those groups? And so if you just took 1% or 2%, a tiny amount of the NIH budget, you could, if you funded every rare disease, you know, which not every rare disease has a patient advocacy organization. So there are about 500 patient advocacy organizations that are full-fledged, bona fide. If you funded every one of those patient advocacy organizations, you could actually put as much money as needed into each of those disorders that you could have a treatment for all of them within 10 years. So he is putting forth this idea that the NIH should set aside, just like they do with small business grants, a tiny percentage of NIH money to go directly to nonprofits and patient advocacy organizations for rare diseases.
Super exciting. I mean, it's really obvious as we do more and more of these conversations and just watch what's happening in rare disease that so much activity is happening with those patient advocacy organizations.
Yeah, they're the ones who care about it. They're the ones who know about it. And truthfully, they are the experts, the world experts in their disorder, because even the doctors who know the most about their disorders, they only know about the medicine. The researchers only know about the mice and the cells. It's these patient advocacy organizations who see the big picture of their tiny little disorder.
So Terry Jo, well, first of all, I want to see if there are other initiatives that you want to promote or you want to mention. But before we do that, what advice would you give to, you know, to another patient advocacy organization or to a parent with a rare disease who's trying to get started? Maybe you could start by advice to other advocacy organizations. As we just said, these folks are doing really important work, but I think some of them are more developed than others. So somebody's new to this or has a not fully developed organization, how should they think about that?
Well, the number one thing they need to do is go ahead and form a nonprofit and become an entity so that they can actually collaborate officially and apply for grants and be part of studies and work. So that's really important, number one. The second thing is, and I guess this will fold into the initiatives I want to talk about. So we do, the first thing we do for any disorder who's part of Combined Brain is we do a conceptual model of the disease. And a conceptual model sounds kind of silly because it is describing what the disease is like. And, you know, usually most doctors who have treated these rare diseases, they really think they already know what the disorder's like. And most parents of kids with these rare diseases, they pretty much think they know what the disease is like. I thought I knew what Angelman was like. I'd been, you know, working in the field as a researcher and as a then a PhD student and as a mom for over 15 years. And I thought I knew everything about Angelman syndrome, but none of us do. What you have to do is go and ask families open-ended questions. You have to say, what's your life like? What's your day like? What is your night like? What happens when you sit down to have dinner? What's your mealtime? And have people describe their lives. Because what doctors think is important or what one mom thinks is important might not be what really matters to everybody with the disorder. So you really have to learn like an anthropologist, like going into a little village in Africa. You have to really try to keep an open mind and learn everything you can about a disorder. And then you can put all the symptoms, all the domains, all the impacts of the disorder into sort of a figure, a diagram. And then from that is how you can build the ways to measure whether a drug is working or not.
Got it. So the conceptual model, if you don't have that, you're not standing on solid ground when you're trying to assess impact.
Yep. Mm-hmm. That's exactly right.
Yeah,
that makes sense. You go back to that, and then you can always refer back to that whenever you're trying to design a clinical trial or create an endpoint. And so you can say, well, you know, maybe you're Mr. Pharmaceutical Firm, you want to measure seizures. But guess what? What really matters to families is communication. And so you're going to have communication be a really important part of this study if this is going to make a difference to families.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. Start with forming an organization, work towards creating a conceptual model. Any other important steps that you want to hit there?
Well, for a brand new disorder, obviously the thing I think is collaboration. So you form your organization, think about a conceptual model, and then start collaborating. Try to figure out who's already doing what you need to do, and do not reinvent a single wheel. Jump right in the same cart with anybody else who's doing what you're doing. You've got to do that to get wherever you're going to go as fast as you possibly can. Don't be all alone in a silo. You're special, but you're not that special.
That's great. I don't know what I like better. Don't reinvent a single wheel, or you're special, but not that special. That's fantastic. I want to give you one last chance, just if there are any other initiatives or organizations that you want to promote and make people aware of.
God, I could go through each of my 26 disorders. I love them. They're super fantastic. There are some big groups that I really, so everybody should join NORD and Global Genes. And if you're in Europe, EURORDIS. If you're going to collect data, you need to make sure to collect it on a platform that where you can share it. We have several endorsed platforms, including The Matrix from Across Healthcare, Citizen, and All Stripes. We work with RDCA DAP and RareX. And all data is power. This is one of the most important things that each of these groups owns. They own information.
Yes.
They ought to share it. Oh, that's my final thing. Privacy makes me sick. I think that if you have a rare disease, the last thing you need to do is preserve your privacy. You need to tell everybody who will listen every single thing you can think of about your medical history, your kid's medical history, your genes, your cells, anything. Be open and transparent, not protective and private. That's probably my main message.
That's wonderful that you're saying that, because by sharing that information, you increase the chances that someone will make a connection, or it'll spur some advance that otherwise might not happen. Is that right?
That's exactly right. So collect data right away. If you are a small organization, it doesn't matter how big you are. If you're one person, start collecting data. Collect it in a regular way. And that is your seat of power. And don't hoard it. Share it. Sell it. Give it to researchers. Whatever you need. That is your goal. That is what you need to get where you're going to go.
I love it. Data is power. Share it. Sell it. Use it. And collaborate is what I'm taking away. Terry Jo, where can people find you online? Where can they go if they want to learn more?
So we are at www.combinedbrain.org. That stands for Consortium for Outcome Measures and Biomarkers for Neurodevelopmental Disorders. It's almost as good as Project Findout, isn't it?
I love it. I love it. People could find you there. Any place else they should go? Any other social media or things?
Rats. Yes, I do have all that. And I forgot what it is.
Well, I think you can find it on your website.
Yeah. So we have Instagram, we have LinkedIn, we have Twitter, and we even have TikTok.
TikTok? TikTok, you say?
Yeah.
All right. Well, I encourage all listeners to go check out the Combined Brain TikTok. I bet you that's exciting, along with all the other resources that Terry Jo has shared. Terry Jo, it was a real pleasure speaking with you. You're doing really exciting and valuable work. Thanks for making the time.
Thank you so much. That was fun.
Okay, that wraps it up for this week. If you enjoyed this podcast or have suggestions for future episodes and how we can make it better, please get in touch with us. You can email us at fewandfarbetween@biorossi.com or contact us on our website at biorossi.com. You can also leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. Thanks again.